folks and friends. I would like to introduce you. Jessica Pichardo is our Vice President of Board here at the Cannabis Alliance, and as well as Founder and Principal of Cannaloops. And I'll turn it over to you. Thank you, Jess.
Hi, everyone. We are on. All right. It's tough to follow that, but we're excited that we have a bridge to our conversation today. I would like to just invite a round of applause for our panelists today. We have Julian Schauer of Canra, Micah Sherman of Raven Farm, David Postman of the LCB, and again, a round of applause for Lori Lucia of Brownsville. So today our panel is Innovation in Cannabis Regulation. We could argue that is the title of this last 10 years, this chapter, that we have had in creating cannabis in Washington, retail cannabis in Washington. And so I'm delighted to have these panelists here. We have some expertise and a lot of light to be shed on this, and it's a good time, especially with the conversations that we've had earlier today. So. We'd like to first start with some introductions, so I'll invite Jillian first.
Is this on? Thanks very much for having me. My name is Jillian Schauer. I'm the Executive Director of the Cannabis Regulators Association. We are a nonpartisan association of state governments involved in regulating cannabis, cannabinoids, and hemp. We have 45 states and 2 territories in our membership, as well as Canada and the Netherlands. We're not an advocacy group. We focus on convening governments to learn from each other. I'm going to talk a little bit later about the challenge that has existed with sort of the federal void. And so Canada came about as an opportunity for states to learn and grow, and we've expanded to other countries as well. So I'm here representing a national perspective. I'm not here to speak to specific policies of Washington State, but hopefully can speak to some of the trends that we've seen. And I'm always grateful to have interaction with different stakeholders. My background is as a researcher. I have a PhD in behavioral science and public health, and then in drug policy for about 20 years. So welcome the opportunity, and hope that lots of people can talk to me after and share your perspectives as well.
Thank you. David.
I am David Postman. I'm the chair of the Liquor and Cannabis Board. Been there a little over 3 years, and most of you probably know, but just real quick, it's a 3-member board. We work part-time, we work 3 days a week, and then we hire our director, who's the full-time manager of the agency. It is, frankly, one of the strangest governance structures in state government to have a part-time over a cabinet-level officer, but it's one of the many remnants we have of the alcohol regulation system that we're still dealing with. And even though, you know, everyone laughed when Lori asked if you trust government, I guess I'm the government guy here today, but, you know, I think that we have, there's so many issues that we agree on, many more than we disagree on. We often get crosswise over process and, you know, the industry is not a monolith, as you may know, There's competing things, and one of the things I'm particularly interested in is how we can move toward a consensus with the industry and the regulators and the legislators. There's a couple here here today, you know, who know so much about your business already and what I do. I think there's a lot of room to have more progress, but I think it takes a lot more work in the interim when we're outside of the legislative session to have these conversations. So look forward to this.
Thanks everybody, my name is Micah Sherman. I'm the co-founder of Raven, also known as Raven Grass, or a farm in the Olympia area. I'm also on the board of the Washington Sun Craft Growers Association, and through that organization helped to found the National Craft Cannabis Coalition. This is a national coalition of state-level trade groups that predominantly represent small and craft growers throughout the country. So, pleasure to be here today and sort of all of those contexts. And my sort of origin story in cannabis policy and advocating in 2016 and 2017, I worked with my representative at the time, Representative Lori Dolan, to introduce a bill. effort to change the market in that way, was sort of what led me into doing this, and you know, still kind of my chief policy goal is that end result. Thanks.
Thanks, Micah. And Hillary, tuning into you, if there's anything else you'd like to add as an introduction to this combo today.
I think the only thing I didn't add about myself is that I guess I'm like low-key government, but not highly. What that mean? I'm glad you asked. I was appointed by the treasurer of Massachusetts to the Cannabis Advisory Board for the Cannabis Control Commission. So I sit on the Market Participation Subcommittee, and I chair the Public Safety and Community Mitigation Subcommittee. So, you know, I dip my toes a little bit. But not full growth, sorry.
I'm with you, Larry. We got to be low-key to make some change, you know? So, all right. Well, the way we'd like to go about this today, we've had some very fruitful conversations, but we've gone long. So we want to make this a productive convo. We're going to chat for a while, and we are going to go to the audience briefly and get some questions. But I ask for your cooperation, so we can do that smoothly. So thank you, everyone. So I'd love to plant the first seed in our convo today about federal versus state regulation. And I want to touch this lightly, because we've touched it quite a bit this morning. But, you know, how has the tension between federal and state cannabis laws impacted the cannabis industry? And I know Julie might have had some comment on that.
Yeah, as an association of government folks at mostly at the state level, I can speak very clearly to this challenge. I think the federal-state tension exists not just in cannabis, but also in the hemp space as well. It has resulted in the cannabis space in states, as you all know well, in Washington, having to set up their entire own system within the state, which is really unlike anything else that we have that's for sale in the country. And I think that's also had implications for the architecture that we see of markets, especially for the first states that were doing this, because they were doing this in an illicit environment where nobody had ever done this before. So I think we saw a lot of focus on compliance and enforcement to try to sort of appease the federal entities as opposed to things that are much more in the regulatory discussion now. So it's influenced, you know, the fact that every state has their own A to Z for cannabis, and also how that sort of A to Z came about. There's an absence of federal guidance on everything from contaminant, you know, thresholds and lab testing to packaging and labeling. And as was mentioned earlier, it is very difficult to have, you know, 45 odd individual state approaches to this when you're a business that is hoping to operate outside of the state. And it's not as easy as waving a magic wand and changing that. I came into my position thinking, hey, there's some things that we can probably get everybody on the same page about. There's no reason we should have different lab testing from state to state, except maybe for metals, you know, packaging and labeling. We should be able to get to some commonalities there. But the bottom line is, it's not as simple as getting regulators on the same page. Every state has their policy being made through state legislatures, and they have different priorities, and they're being lobbied by different groups. And so it really, I think, will take some federal minimum standards to harmonize. And I don't think that you will be able to see individual states come together and say, this is what good looks like, let's all do it. Because somewhere along the line, something's going to get off the rails. So we do need federal minimum standards, and we need federal guidance in spaces where the feds usually give guidance, and they're not. Which is honestly one of the reasons that CAMRA originated, because states needed a place to talk about, what do we do with this situation? We've never faced this before. What are other states doing? And then I think it's exacerbated the situation where policy is far ahead of the research. You know, the federal dynamic around research has also been challenged, and that was talked about a little bit with rescheduling. So as a researcher, I just want to sort of give my opinion there. I don't think that rescheduling is going to just bang open the box on research. I don't think we're going to see a ton of research. It changes a couple things that we know are likely, and then there may be some unknowns. It basically means that a researcher can have a smaller safe, and that when they make a change to their study protocol, they don't have to go through the DEA, but they still have to go through the DEA when they start. They still have to go through the FDA when they start. So there's been this tension around getting the data we need about the plant, the data we need to regulate the plant, and setting minimum standards. So one of the things that I think all of our regulators agree on is we need more federal engagement in this space to help the situation on the ground.
Thanks, Julie. Micah, did you, or David, did you have a comment?
Obviously, this is a very open-ended question, so I'm trying to decide where to answer it in a way. core of my business and my interest as a cultivator is really kind of fundamentally most influenced by the state regulations that we operate in. And because of the scale that I operate at, that's ultimately going to be the case. So I do think it's important that we track on federal issues, that we understand how they're going to affect us. But for a vast majority of the market structure, the distributional questions, all of these things that really fundamentally affect kind of what the cannabis economy looks like and who's in charge of it, is going to be determined by state rules for quite a long time into the future, many years, no matter what happens at the federal level. So I think that's really important for us to kind of mention really strongly up front, is that the work that we're doing at the state level matters a great deal and is going to continue to matter a great deal even post descheduling. We're still going to have state regulations that determine who can buy what from whom, in what terms, in what conditions, what's allowed to be made and sold in that state. And so we're seeing that in hemp, where the sort of, it's federally legal, but it's still up in the air about what can be done in different states. So that's a reality that we need to get square in our minds all the time, is that it really matters a lot what we do in Olympia, in the legislature. We have an awful lot of work to do in that arena to bring us to a place where we could even hope to coherently respond to a federal status change. Were it to be litigated right now and it was thrust upon us, we would be in a really difficult position. So I think it's important for us to, in this conversation about, you know, sort of innovation in cannabis regulations, talk a lot about what things look like here in the state, so that when a meaningful material federal status change occurs, that we're prepared to do that. And so, a couple of examples of those policies at the federal level that we work on through the NCCC is, the first is called the SHIP Act. And the SHIP Act was introduced, and it would have allowed direct-to-consumer sales for cannabis products grown by a small cannabis producer through the mail upon descheduling. And that bill was really about introducing the idea of market crafting into the minimum standards that Jillian just referred to at the federal level. So one of the things we were looking to guarantee was that cultivators and consumers can have a direct relationship, so that relationship between, you know, caretaker of the plant and the consumer of the product is as direct as possible. And then the rest of the industry, the rest of the ecosystem, that's the term that's got referred to a lot today, the rest of the business ecosystem can be predicated on that core relationship being available to both the grower and the consumer. And that opens up opportunities to build a business ecosystem that has a fundamental unit that produces a particular kind of result. And so that sort of result of direct-to-consumer relationships with farmers, for me, is key to building a sustainable business ecosystem in the cannabis industry. So that's a sort of policy that I think at the federal level would be real meaningful for us.
Thank you, Micah. And I appreciate, you know, especially on the heels of all this rescheduling news, being in a room full of like-minded people who can stop, drop, and roll, and just pause to understand things better and ask questions, because there's a lot that's unknown. So I appreciate being amongst those like-minds. I'd like to drop another seed when it comes to innovation in cannabis regulation in regards to social equity. We've heard the buzzword a lot today. And so I'd love to just pose a question of, how does social equity play in cannabis regulation, and how maybe have different states approach this? We know how Washington's doing, currently still in the throes of building that program and getting equity licenses out to licensees. Jillian, perhaps you could start with a little bit of the national perspective on how that's going.
Sure. I think every state regulator in the space would tell you that nobody's gotten it perfect. I think we've learned from folks like Pat Packer and Troy Hutchinson, who were early regulators fighting for equity. And I think we've learned that there are some best practices around three pillars. One would be equity in the marketplace. One would be expungements, making sure those are automatic and easy to get, happen at the state and county level. And then the other would be community reinvestment. I think we've seen states try at those and learn some lessons, but we still, this is one of our most talked about issues at Canberra. because it's really tough to figure out how to do it right and where the learnings are. I think we engage with a lot of stakeholders to try to get better at that. As a public health person, I think the community reinvestment stands to have a really huge impact on disproportionately impacted communities. Not everybody who's been harmed by the war on drugs wants to or can get a license, but you know, if we are giving money to those communities that were harmed to repair some of those harms, I think that can go a long way. And I am personally concerned, this is not an official cannabis position, but I'm personally concerned about, as the market is shifting more towards cannabinoid hemp, and we see a lot more sales happening in cannabinoid hemp now than we do in state-regulated markets, I'm concerned about what that means for equity. I'm concerned about how we're advancing equity in hemp. I'm not aware of any states that have an equity program for cannabinoid hemp, even states that are trying to regulate it. I'm also concerned about what that means for tax revenue that will not be collected from the sale of state-regulated products because it's coming through cannabinoid hemp, and particularly the revenue that was going to be reinvested in communities that were disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs. So I think we have a lot of work to do, and Canada has been having conversations, and at our meeting in a few weeks, we'll be having a panel on this, and we're working with MCBA and others to continue these discussions about how do we advance equity when it comes to hemp, and how do we continue to serve communities that have been harmed by the war on drugs. So that's what's on my mind.
Thanks, Jillian. We got some claps. Lori, I want to just tap in and see if you had some comments with this seat.
Yeah, thank you. Social equity is really difficult because it comes down to defining what it means and who are the participants. Like I said in my talk, the government literally came out and said they were targeting hippies and black people. But then the Supreme Court said, you got to jump through fire in order to remediate some of the harms that were caused on the basis of race. It's very difficult to have race-based restorative justice practices, and that's a difficult aspect of social equity, because I don't need to say, you have seen social equity applicants who probably should not be social equity applicants. I mean, I'm a black woman. I personally almost feel like I shouldn't even qualify for economic economy. Why? My dad ran the telecommunication department for Haiti, the country. He's an engineer. My mom is a freaking nurse. I'm a lawyer. My sisters are I'm not the target for this. I've never even come close to being arrested. So we need to make sure that we define this community effectively so that the resources, the finite resources that we have, gets funneled to the proper people who actually need it. So that to me is the most difficult part. How do we define this group? We already know what we need to provide, community investment. We need to provide them grants. We need to provide them real estate, etc. But the who is what we really need to come to a definition and consensus of.
Thank you. In the same lane of social equity, I wanted to, maybe David, tap in with you. The question is, how can cannabis regulation address the disparities, again, caused by past drug policies, especially in disadvantaged communities? I'd love to know your take here in Washington. I'd love to hear from the LCB.
Well, thanks. I'll say this. It's one of the most important things we're working on now, and it is by far the hardest. For a lot of reasons, but for me personally, it really has been tough. And you know, I was thinking, Lori, during your lunch talk, when you talk about those dates back to 1924, we only have to go back to 2012 when the initiative passed, by a large majority, by the way. You know, more people voted for legal cannabis than voted for the governor or the attorney general that year. So it was a big vote. With not one word about social equity. It wasn't in that ecosystem. It wasn't in, you know, the ACLU brought that forward. It's harm reduction. It was harm reduction in a window. And it didn't look at that. And then, you know, they came to the legislature to start building what that program looked like. And again, not part of it. And so we're really late to the game. Now, some of the newer states, enough has changed in that 10 years that when they do start to legalize, they're at least part of the conversations from the start, which I think is better. But as Julian said, no one's figured it out yet. No one can point to a program and goes, see, it works. greatest good company because it's got the most money going to it. I mean, it's gonna it can be a real powerful tool. Licensing has to be a part of it though, because of that issue of what were the state's role. And we know the state played a role in what this market looks like today. We have a responsibility to play a role to make it more equitable. There are people in the industry who disagree with that. And we've been able to keep moving forward, but not at the pace that we would have liked, or the pace that some of the applicants would like. But it's not something everybody agrees on. It's still a fight. And it is true, it's very hard. And all the advice we got was don't do a race-conscious system because it will end up in the courts so fast. And this was during the Trump years, and still it's his court, you know. So if you want to bet on the Supreme Court to stand up for a social equity program, we would rather have a program that is immune from that, or at least protected from that, and that's what we're trying to build. But it's very, very hard. There's a lot of anger in the community. There's a lot of distrust. There are, you know, loud voices that don't think I'm an honest broker in that conversation. And all I can tell you is it's something I work on every day at the LCB. And there's people there who are with me to only try to make it look like we all would say we want it to look like. But it is really difficult to do. We don't, you know, we have to go to the legislature to get the authority to do it. Then they've been good about doing it. Then we've got to come up with the rules for it. Then hopefully people agree on what to use for it. Should it be somebody who's a lawyer who could qualify, whose father is wealthy or not? What about jail time? You know, what about the war on drugs? The legislature was very specific about that the social equity program was to right the wrongs of the war on drugs. It was not harm reduction. It was very specific. But not that specific. So what does that mean? How do you do that? And we've researched criminal records. I've gone back and read papers that have been written decades ago about the war on drugs, about what the charges were that most frequently were used, what the racial disparities were of those, and how they were used in different places to try to figure out how we do it. And even the point of what's the burden to the applicant? So if we have a qualifying checklist, and one of those things we want to see is, you know, did you lose your house because of a criminal conviction or something? Well, that could be 15, 20 years ago. People said, how do I find that? How do I document that? How do I prove that? And so people didn't, you know, so we've been able to look, and we've got to make sure that we're not setting up hurdles here that are impossible to meet. I talk about a lot, but one thing I would say is I really hope that those that are in the industry today can help us with this in terms of input, advice, mentorship of the new licensees, working together, because we're going to do this. There are some people in the industry that don't want us to continue with the licenses that we're doing. I get requests to stop. Can't you stop it? No, we can't, and we don't want to. But we need you all to be part of that too, and to say we welcome that competition, we can survive with that competition. And the last thing I'll say is I'll give a plug, if I could, work for Parabola, because I've been reading everything on the website the last couple of weeks, and you know, there's an article there, how to federally legalize cannabis without violating the Constitution or undermining equity and justice. So understand that even when people get excited about rescheduling national legalization and decriminalization, social equity could be a victim in any of those things. Other state programs too, which I care about, but that's a big one. So we have to really pay attention, and you should all go and read that article. It's really, it's great. Thank you.
Thank you, David. All right, we're going to move on to our next C, which would be regulation, the economic impact and innovation of that regulation. So the question is, how has the legal cannabis industry impacted local and state economies? What innovations have emerged from this industry, and what are the implications? I know, Mike, perhaps maybe you want to go with that.
I want to take just 1 minute to say something about the last topic.
Please.
So, and this is kind of related to what I'm going to say, is the war on drugs we've talked a lot about today, and I just want to sort of say something that I think is a little distinct, is that the war on drugs was started not because we didn't like drugs. It was because we wanted to control the behavior of communities and people that already used those substances. And so we're not gonna, in my opinion, solve the war on drugs by essentially relying on cannabis and the cannabis industry to remedy those harms. I think it's a small component of what a social equity program might look like, and I think that it's not appropriate to the scale of the problem of the war on drugs to put it at the feet of the cannabis industry alone to remedy those harms. And I think that it sort of does a disservice to the memory of the war on drugs to just focus on our industry. The war on drugs is about housing, the war on drugs is about finance. So I think it's very important that we put in right size like what we can do in our industry to go back and solve all those problems. We can do a lot, but it's limited in the sphere that we operate in. And so having said that, I think Amber spoke to this really well earlier, like developing a business ecosystem that is mindful of that history and understands what it's going to take for us to have an industry that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, people can come into and have a system that they can operate in and be successful at a small scale. And so that's something that I think we need to permanently work towards having be an integral part of the cannabis industry. And I do think that, you know, I came into this industry in 2013 from doing other work in the world because I knew that this was going to be a moment where norms in a transitioning industry from the illicit market to a regulated market was going to be probably one of the biggest transitionary moments that I had the opportunity to participate in. And I wanted to make sure that values that I felt good about, which are about the sort of developing ecosystem that people that are growing the plant and consuming the plant are the drivers of what's going on in our industry. I think that's really important to social equity, because that's about making sure that community is in charge of how things go, which is, for me, just as important as who keeps the bag at the end of the transaction and who gets to make the decisions about what that happens along the way. And so I think developing a system where we really identify who's in control of the decision-making process is about what matters, how it's valued, who gets to buy what from whom. All of those questions about market structure allow us to make moments where we can build successfully into these social equity programs, but if we don't have that small business ecosystem, we're not going to be able to bring those sorts of programs in. And the last thing I'll say is, there's also been a lot of conversation about small versus big today. And I want to mention a different distinction, which is what I like to call the fire sector. So finance, insurance, and real estate versus what I call the real economy, which is what we do. And so if we create a paradigm where the fire sector's interests are the guiding force in what we do and why we do it, which is the direction we're headed right now, we're going to have a cannabis industry that is oriented and subservient to interests other than cannabis, and interests other than cannabis patients, and interests other than cannabis growers, consumers. We're going to be oriented towards the interests of financial intermediaries, insurance networks, and the real estate system. And so I think we need to be really clear and directed in that we want a cannabis economy that's primarily interested in the production of cannabis, and not the production of real estate profits, and not the production of insurance profits. And so small versus big is important, but there are big players that are our allies in that fight against the fire sector control of our economy. And so I don't want to be centrally planned by Wall Street. I want to be locally planned by business owners that are touching the plant and know what's going on. And so I think that's where the cannabis industry can be a model for the rest of our society, in that we don't have to industry is organized, we can do it in a new way and empower business operators over that sector. So.
And if I can,
this, yeah, this is a clash. So we are going to keep going.
If I can jump in, I think we're at a really pivotal time to talk about those market architecture questions because of the change that's afoot with Canada OEM and the change that's afoot with interstate commerce and, you know, channeling some of the interstate commerce remarks from this morning. We have interstate commerce, right? We have it from traditional markets. We have it from new illicit markets. We have it from Canada OEM. The only place we don't have it is state-regulated cannabis. But as we're in this pivotal moment of thinking about what is the market going to be, are we going to bring cannabinoids together somehow? I think it's really important to think about what survives in an interstate or multinational environment in your state. And this is a question that regulators are starting to think about. What survives? What do they want to survive? And do you have the policies in place now to protect and grow what you want to survive? So those are essential, critical questions for boards, regulatory agencies, and stakeholders to be talking about together. Because I think there's a critical window right now where we need to be having those conversations and making any necessary changes.
And this is such a big issue right now for regulators, and it is for us. And I tell you, we get a lot of pressure right now from some in the industry who say, all these great things are about to happen federally. We need to get ready for it. And that means we need outside capital investments. We shouldn't have residency requirements. You know, we gotta, but there's a lot in this system that, I don't know, any day now it may look like it's quaint, you know, but the fact that we have, still have a prohibition on out-of-state investment, that we, in our social equity program, we have a residency requirement. A lot of people don't want that, and it's going to, if there's national legalization, changes like that. And so we do need to think about, you know, what are the pieces that's important to all of us, and all of us means the consumer and the legislature and public health and everybody else, and what can we go to Congress and say, when you do this, don't lose sight of this piece here, because I don't think we'd be having these conversations thinking that legalization is even anywhere on the horizon if the states hadn't done a pretty good job setting up these recreational markets. And by the state, I mean the people who have the licenses too. The parade of horribles that people predicted before this initiative passed have not come true. And that's from public health, and that's from law enforcement. It is not true. And it has, because we all kind of overreacted at the beginning. We needed to in order to get the Obama administration's, you know, kind of uneasy truce with us to let us go forward. If those states start to lose regulatory control, if those parade of horribles start to emerge, I don't think that's going to lead the federal government to act sooner to legalize. They're going to slow down, and they may even try to crack down on us. I don't think that's going to happen. I do want to say the cannabis industry is so much better than the alcohol industry in terms of the, one of the most important things is keeping the product out of the hands of children. You know, we meet every week in closed session, the board does, to issue violation notices and to hear appeals and those sorts of things. Every time we make those comments, like, well, these folks can do it, why can't they do it? And we talked about it in the meeting just the other day. So that's how we've gotten to where we are, is because I think the industry across the country has operated in a professional manner. I think that regulators have kept their wits about them in terms of, you know, we do have to operate under this rubric that was sort of forced on us under the Cole memo. It doesn't really exist today, but it kind of exists in the negative form, and we're not sure where that line is, and we're trying to find out. So we got to evolve, we got to mature, we got to change. We gotta, you know, that curve of acceptance and things like that is coming too quick. We have legislators in our legislature who say that the initiative was a failed experiment and should be repealed immediately. So we're not to total acceptance by any means. Now on the flip side, they say is that in 2012, Jay Inslee opposed the cannabis initiative, as did all the statewide candidates, I think, at least the major party ones. And then he ran for president one day. I was in my office, and somebody came in and said, the governor was in Los Angeles and just said that Washington has the best weed in America. I thought, well, he didn't even want it in the first place, you know? But he's out there talking about Washington wine, and now it's Washington cannabis and talking about, so that change is coming. folks. But it's going to take a while for us to even get our authorized environment to be committed to the expansion that some people want.
Change always comes around election time. All right, Lori, I just wanted to check in. We have some lively commentary there. Did you have anything to add before we move on to our next seat?
No, I think that one of the things that stuck out to me is the conversation about folks not necessarily needing to be put into licenses, but being reinvested into in whatever endeavors that they wanted to do prior to enforcement. I know many people who are selling weed to drop an album, right? I know many people who are selling weed to take care of their family. Like, their social equity to me, licensing, is completely ridiculous. And I also think that social equity should expand to include ancillary businesses. For example, in Massachusetts, there was money that was given to social equity businesses, but only to licensees. But there are many companies that don't have licenses that are brands that should have had access to that money as well. I think by limiting it to just licensees, we're missing a mark. And we're also not in alignment with how business is done globally. Most companies are not manufacturing their own branded products. That just doesn't happen. I own a brewery. I don't brew all my own beer. I wouldn't be able to keep up with distribution. I hire a company and they make my recipes for me. And so recognizing that that's the way that business is conducted globally, ancillary businesses, including brands, should have a pathway for accessing funding and resources as well, in addition to folks who don't want anything to do with cannabis, who might want to still work on that album and drop a main 16. That's me. Work on those bars, okay? Get to use them here. So we want it to be more inclusive. We want it to really impact people in a significant way. And it cannot just be licenses.
Yeah, you're getting a round of applause in here, Larry. And I appreciate that sentiment. You know, so many of us did so many things before we were in cannabis. And now that's the common thread that ties us together, but entrepreneurs of all kinds find themselves taking the big green leap, so I appreciate you knowing that. Okay, I'm looking at time, so I wanted to just go through maybe one more here and talk about the public's health and safety kind of piece, and what the best practices are for ensuring public health and safety in cannabis regulation is there, and how our state can ensure the cannabis products are safe for consumers. So I'm going to start with Jillian.
Yeah, so on our website, we just on Wednesday launched a public-facing best practice and guidance document on regulating cannabinoids for safety. It was a great process. It aggregates insight from regulators from many different jurisdictions, and anytime we convene in camera, we let them come to the table with their expertise, not necessarily with what their state is having them implement, but I think it frees them up to think about what does good look like. So we came up with 7 different areas that we think are important for regulating for safety. And I want to focus on regulating cannabinoids for safety, not just regulating cannabis for safety, because there's an opportunity to create more consumer safety in the hemp market right now as well, too. So that's licensing and registration of cannabinoid processors, manufacturers, and retailers, a bunch of different things under processing and manufacturing standards, again, things that are standard in a lot of different businesses. Age gating for cannabinoid products, especially things that might be intoxicating. Product form, dose, and content regulations, especially on the heels of the vaping lung injury outbreak. Packaging and labeling regulations to really fully inform consumers about what they're consuming and what's in the products they're consuming. This is something that we all want in every product we consume. And when we go to the grocery store or gas station, I think everybody rightly assumes that there's a level of regulation to keep them safe for what they're purchasing. Some advertising regulations, you know, so advertisements are not misleading, don't make false statements, and then education, compliance, and enforcement. So each of these buckets, I think, has a lot under it. The framework that we put out gives a lot of flexibility, but those are the core pieces that our membership felt like were really important to protect consumers. And at the end of the day, while regulatory agencies vary often in their mission, the one thing that they all have in common in their mission is protecting consumer safety. That is why you have a regulator. Whether you choose to like them or dislike them, they are often just trying to do their job of protecting consumer safety. which has been made really difficult by the void in science in this space. So productive engagement is the most valuable thing that you can do. Instead of saying, I hate this regulation, come to the table with, here's a different way that we could do this. I often hear people say, the market's overregulated. My first question to them is always, what regulations could we do without that don't compromise consumer safety? Like, we are all ears. Tell me what we could do about. And I think most regulators would do everything to try to strip that down. So I hope that we're at the beginning of a discussion about consumer safety, again, as we're looking at the hemp space and thinking about how that reflects on what we've done in cannabis.
Thanks, Jen. And one more time, the name of the resource you said it dropped this week. So
if you go to our website, which is cann-ra.org, it's under the news. It's just the best practices and guidance for regulating cannabinoids for safety.
Thank you.
David? This is great, and we are focused more and more on public health, trying to help. We just added it to our mission statement, which surprisingly was some amount of debate internally, but it is one of the prime things we do. I think the industry has done a pretty good job in Washington State in terms of minding the public health. But what I want to mention is that there is a large community in Washington State. We meet with regularly the prevention public health people. Some of them are government health agencies. Some of them are nonprofits and things of the sort, who have a very different view than I do and that you all do. And we have different views. And they worry a great deal about everything. So I talked about, kind of this overreach that we all had to do at the beginning, the Cole Memo syndrome. I don't think that's the model for long term, but public health and prevention likes that. Anything we move away from that feels like a loss to them. And so I just say this, is that there's always some debate about this, and a quick example is science. I've had some conversations with a couple of retail licensees about how big the science can be, and there's pretty specific regulations around that. Is that a priority for us? No, but it's on the books, what do we do? We supported legislation this last session working with a lot of different cannabis business owners and organizations. We were going to do our own version, got too pumped, we decided we would work with the sponsor of another bill. We're trying to get there. Seemed reasonable, but I can tell you, we get a lot of pushback from prevention and public health. They're very worried that we might allow science this big rather than this big. And I'm not belittling that. That to them is real. They worry about normalization. They don't want to normalize what you do. Now, I think the voters normalized it in 2012, and it's our turn to regulate it. I really worry about it. And if they don't. And so all these things, which may seem so simple to the business owner, why are you getting up on a ladder and measuring square inches of my sign when you should be worrying about the guy down the street who's got product going up the back door? We can do that. But I think what we're going to do well, in the LCB, in terms of the sign discussion, is make the case for what we could do if we weren't doing that. And I think you'll see that we'll try to talk about that more specifically the next time that issue comes up.
Thank you. All right, we'd like to give everybody maybe just mind it first a moment, and then we're going to go to y'all for some questions and skip the chat. So get your questions ready to go.
Just to sort of comment on the public health thing. So the most important thing we can do for public health and safety in regards to cannabis policy is end the war on drugs.
Yes.
Because the harm from the war on drugs came from prohibition and from law enforcement, not from drugs. And so we need to disabuse ourselves of the notion that we need to solely focus on protecting ourselves from cannabis, and we need to protect ourselves from the forces in our society that have caused this harm, and not completely set up our regulatory processes around protecting us from cannabis, because cannabis has both benefits and drawbacks, and stigmatizing its use in this new era of moving out of prohibition, which we still remain in, into something else. I think it's really important that our regulatory structures start being about building something positive and constructive, instead of just being in a reactive mode where we're trying to respond to the damages of the past. Those are really important to be mindful of, but that's not the be-all, end-all of what cannabis regulation should be about. the wreckage of horrible public policy that destroyed lives for generations. And we have to be mindful that we can't overreact on demonizing something that is relatively safe and has been used by humans for tens of thousands of years. And so this relatively new and novel approach to drug regulation was a failure, was always a failure. That approach will always be a failure, and we need to completely divest ourselves from that approach. And that's, in my opinion, the most critical aspect of public health and drug policy is to end the war on drugs.
Ooh, was there a round of applause? All right, so we are going to take some questions, and it looks like we have
one. I could add my two cents to
this. Oh, please, oh. Yes, and I will get ready for our first question.
So this is my only issue with framing it in terms of the public health for keeping people safe. I really want to enumerate what the risks are. Like, what are we actually protecting the consumers from? The only thing I think that the risk is contaminated products. Intestine. Apart from that, all we're doing is we're actually empowering consumers with information. It's not protecting their safety. Remember, my concern with like couching and safety, Anslinger and his homies first, that's the tactic they use. We gotta keep the American people safe. Specifically, we gotta keep our white women safe. This was in his market. If you smoke marijuana, it's gonna cause the white women to leave. The white men, they go sleep with black men. That was the propaganda. And I'm like, dude, that's what happened to our dad. There are very minimal risks with consuming cannabis. And to rise to the level of protecting the consumers, we are educating the consumers. We're protecting the consumers from contaminated products. But apart from that, we are just educating. And kids, I know kids should not smoke marijuana, but how many children have actually died from consuming cannabis? So like, we need to really put these risks into perspective, because if we just say for protecting public safety, we might run the risk of creating some Anslinger-esque hysteria, which is not helpful to anyone. So that's Big Mama's two cents. Let's call it consumer education, consumer empowerment, and the risk only limiting it to testing.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you. All right, we have our first question from Ms.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. You guys are amazing, and I really appreciate that you're here. I represent social equity applicants, licensees, and also contractors administering programs. And something that we discuss a lot is what seems to be the inevitable paternalistic characteristics of social equity, of restricting when you can sell your license, how you can sell your license, whatever. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how to address that. I mean, it's a hard problem, right? But I was wondering if you have any thoughts about how to move that discussion, hopefully, over and then move on to other, you know, topics.
I know, I'm sorry.
It's not an easy question.
I don't feel like nationally we have the right answers to that. And we've seen states take different approaches. You know, the obvious concern is if anyone can just sell their license, then you end up with a program that has no equity left in it. And I mean, it's a tough one. Like, this is one of those questions that we talk about in Canada circles all the time, and states sort of share, this is the approach that we took, and this is how it's working. And I think they're hybrid approaches, right, where you keep your license for a certain period of time, or you sell it to another equity, but you know, then you're limiting people's earning potential. So it's not one where I feel like I have an answer, and if you have suggestions, like, I'd love to hear, because I, like, we need creative thinking to get this right, so I'm all ears.
I too don't have the answer, but that's short version. But you know, one thing, and Representative Morgan can say this much better than I, but you know, even during the discussions around the task force, there's a lot of disagreements in any group of people who we've discussed social equity with about some of those very things, about how long do you keep it, you know, in the hands of a juice system. We start a certain way, get it started, but then we've got to see. We've got to be able to, and luckily we're able to do that already because we have the first social equity program. Those licenses are just getting out. We've got the second one that'll start at the end of the year or early next year. We learn, so what can change? And I think we're going to grow on those. And those are the things, again, if you look at what's happening nationally, could change all those leases so dramatically. Dormant Commerce Clause, you know, what happens to our residency department? Luckily, so far, we've won that. But the fights are coming up.
Well, and Lori talked about the importance of defining equity 100%, because as soon as we get interstate commerce, if there's not a universal definition, like what happens to those programs, how do you preserve those programs, like we have a lot of foundational work to do, and that's one of like 100 questions that I think is important to that.
Rachel, I have a question from the chat, if I can, Mike, and you might be able to roll it in about Washington. So from Andy Brassington, Evergreener, what changes to the Washington industry do you expect to see in the next 3 years?
I just want to real quickly respond to Vinci. In my opinion, the social equity programs that leverage limited licensure as the mechanism for bringing values to the social equity license aren't, that's not a long-term viable strategy, and I think those conversations about selling licenses are often predicated on the limited license or bringing value to the license outside of the value of the business. So I think our goal with those equity programs needs to be to create viable businesses that are valuable independently of limited licensure, because limited licensure is temporary, it's going to go away, and if we want long-term viability of those programs, it needs to be designed around not leveraging that. So that would be my answer to that, is designing social equity programs that lowers that. And then as far as changes in the next 3 years, I think that we're going to see largely, at least our day-to-day operations are going to be more or less how they are right now, with the possibility that we can get some changes in the next few years in the legislature to update our rules to some of the focuses that I've talked about here is moving away from responding to prohibition into building something new. I think we need to look at how additional agencies can be leveraged to resource our industry with the sorts of things we need to be successful. So that includes, you know, expanding the Department of Agriculture's role in our program, collating hemp and cannabis into a single program that then diverts off into high THC, low THC, so that we can have a coherent, comprehensive program for the cannabis plant, not these two sort of divergent programs that don't really make any sense. So I hope that we can see iterative legislative progress, and that we can enable the LCB and the other agencies that are in charge of regulating our industry with the tools and resources they need to update our laws from a reaction to the Cole memo to being something that's forward-thinking and is trying to build the sort of ecosystem that we've been talking about all day.
And I think that's our goal. And was the payment petition yours?
Yeah.
So just the other day we approved this rules petition on the payment thing, which took us a year to do because we've had a lot of turnover in that department, and you know nothing's easy.
Love next door accountability.
And so just want to, you know, yeah, I think they'd be great. But it's a kind of common sense evolution. That's one of those things that when it comes to us, it's like, yeah, okay, I understand why the law was like it was, or why the rule was the way it was originally. Some of that is, if you call it, an alcohol hangover from Tide House and those laws, but this is a different issue, it's a different time. So I would say that one of the things I hope we see from us over the next 2-3 years is more of that sort of work. We are working internally to where are those things that don't get us much. You know, it's not advancing public safety, it's not advancing public health, it's not advancing even consumer education. If it's tax collections, it's going to remain really important. But there's things that maybe aren't, and we can take that step back. And so I think traditions like that itself are helpful.
Thank you. We have two more questions. We're going to try and make time for both, for sure.
Hello, my name is Walter Terry, and I'm with Panacea Cannabis. And I do marketing for them. In the store experience, in the state of Nevada, You could go to the store, and they put it in a small little container. You can smell the product. That's a big disadvantage because the consumer doesn't know what they're buying. Cannabis, when I was out in the gray market, the consumer made the decision based on how it smelled.
Yes.
And you can't smell it in the state of Washington. So for public safety, a real consumer in cannabis will know what they're buying by smelling it. So why didn't the state allow the retailer to put it in a little small case like the state of Nevada where we can smell the product?
Good question.
No, no.
Well, see, what, we do a scratch and sniff maybe on the package, but somebody, we raised this question maybe, but from a different angle, which was about packaging. If we had bulk flour, you wouldn't have as much waste from the packaging and all of that, and so why don't you do that? And that would allow them to do that. So I hadn't thought of that. That's good one. And
Thank you, David.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks, Walter.
All right,
we have one final question today.
Thank you. My name is Pat Rogers. I'm a retail cannabis lawyer here. I was in that prior to getting my store, and then also in the medical office. We do have the sniff jars are available here in Washington. Not commonly used because you have to inventory, keep track of them, and be accountable for them. Number one, so another manifest item, and then also, they only smell for so long.
Right.
And they don't come every week. So, and you have to order them and then send it back. So it's cumbersome. So and we didn't have the request from, and if you've got good product, you can typically smell through the jar and or that's one of my tests. Yeah. My question is, I'm going to go on to my question. My question is, well, what are the in my opinion, as a retailer, one of the things I haven't heard talked about at all today was the tax in Washington State with our sales tax is 47%. And then I have my national tax, federal tax, it exceeds 40%. And we're talking about why are we having trouble getting the social equity stores online? Because nobody applies on financing. Because after they look at our books, they say, you can't afford to repay it. I'm not going to make any money on my store until I sell it at all. Because I don't get to walk away with any profit. You take a minimum wage, $100,000 a month. I don't have a big bank account. But that's the reality, and it hasn't changed. Our market hasn't been growing, for at least in our area. We have more marijuana. Now we're talking about exporting. I don't think the export things can help most of us cannabis retailers. It will help the bigger chains, the bigger growers, the very top of the line growers, the St. Michelle's of the cannabis business. But I think it's going to hurt the rest of us. That's just my opinion. And if the state can comment, if you have any comments, has there been any discussion about lowering taxes? That's my main question.
Yeah.
That's
our main. I'll tell you, the legislators can confirm this. You know, when taxation questions come up around cannabis, the LCB has historically, bravely and boldly taken no position. So they've had this sort of practice, which is, well, that's not our bad. That's Department of Revenue or that's somebody else. I think that these things are now enmeshed so much in actual policy that we are looking at them differently, and certainly around high THC it comes up, and so we're trying to have a different level of conversation about that, and we're evolving. So I don't know that the LCB would be the agency that would go and say let's reduce the taxation as much, because one of the real benefits that y'all brought is money for the state treasury, and
we know this.
Yes,
and, we do know.
Yes, and you know it's more than people thought, and it's paying for great things. And now we're able to do even the reinvestment fund. So anytime anything comes away from that, some people are going to not like cannabis as much as they do today. So we have to figure out how to do this. How do we modernize the tax system, particularly if there's national competition or interstate business? Without cutting that hole. Now, I got to believe if the federal government does legalize cannabis, it's going to come with its own tax, right? They don't do that out of the goodness of their heart. We didn't either, but you know, they are
Chilean,
right?
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to chime in. A lot of people in the industry, the national hopefully there'll be a lot of stakeholders around the table to talk about what's already happened in states and what that federal tax adds to what states are already doing.
We win the best weed game, but we also win the highest tax game on weed, so not the one we want to win. All right, I just want to tackle with Lori real quick for any final thoughts, and then I'll tackle with our panelists, and we'll be done for the day.
I like that we started talking about taxes, because it's one of my favorite things. But that's how you know how the government wants to control the people. You see the benefits they give you for taxes. So I personally feel like social equity company legitimate once they define it. They shouldn't have to pay taxes. That's really the we give them real benefits to overcome the actual hurdles that prevent them from operating successful businesses, and that actually makes them want to run out of the industry. If they don't have to pay taxes, they are well positioned to succeed, first of all. Secondly, the federal government and state governments, municipal governments, use their tax dollars to unjustly enforce these prohibitionist laws against them. I think it's balanced, it makes sense. And fortunately, because of the economic system we have in the United States, there's never going to be that many social equity businesses, no matter what we do. So it's not going to cut in that much into the tax revenue for the states and the federal government. So if we're considering, rewriting regulations, consider removing taxes, the need to pay taxes for legitimate social equity businesses. So they can bring up the taxes. The taxes are core. I tell my nieces about it all the time. I go in their rooms, I grab their toys, and I say, I'm the IRS. So, you know, that's my two cents.
All right, any final thoughts from our other panelists?
I would just leave people with the reminder to engage respectfully and productively with your regulators. I've worked in government for 15 years. They are some of the hardest working folks in government, even if you dislike what they're doing. So come to them with solutions, not with problems. And Canada's here to listen. We're focused mostly at the national and international level because I can't be in 50 states and I can't work with 50 plus state trade associations. But we want to hear from stakeholders too. And I take all the data points and feedback I get really seriously and try to make sure that regulators in all states are hearing those perspectives. So please engage because your engagement's important.
Thank you. And as a reminder, the Alliance is dedicated to the advancement of vital, ethical, equitable, and sustainable cannabis industry, and that's what we all do together. So if you're not already a member, if your neighbor's not a member, please engage with them and have them join us for the work that we do, and hopefully join us again next year. I want to thank